Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Indiana Mania. So, on Monday, we began our journey in 1936, and now we're heading back to 1935 as Indy goes on an accidental adventure in India with his sidekick Short Round and a screaming woman. From 1984, it's the film that created the PG-13 rating, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
If adventure has a name, it must be Indiana Jones. From Steven Spielberg and George Lucas. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
We'll have a winner at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Putters. We are going to die.
I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
Part two of Indiana Mania, Temple of Doom. Excited, Chris?
Yes.
You've been looking forward to this moment for a while, haven't you?
Yep, ever since Monday.
Yeah, I sort of meant the general Indiana Mania thing. I'm really pushing that as a brand name for us.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, I have been for a long time.
Great stuff. Victoria?
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Did a great job with Raiders on Monday.
Thank you.
Mm. You could see I was drinking. You thought you'd just end.
Yeah? Yeah, sorry.
It's all right.
Why were you drinking then?
Because there's a lot to get through with Temple of Doom, okay. As always. When it's my movie, yep. I go overboard.
Not as much as Raiders, so you'll be keeping the time down.
No, actually, there seems to be more.
No,
based on what Vicky did on Monday, I think there's actually more to talk about with Temple of Doom. Very quickly, if you haven't subscribed to us, if you would be kind enough to do so, that would be amazing on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you could leave us a rating, awesome. And if you could leave us a review, double awesome. Why? Because you may hear Chris Tilly, aka Chris Thrilly, read it out on the show. It sounds a bit like this.
This is from E. Stoves, who says, "Brilliant podcast for fans of movies. Alex Zane is a tour de force despite losing the vote every week. Vicky Crompton artfully takes you through character arcs while inexplicably dropping salty catchphrases. Chris Thrill a Minute Tilly provides interesting film trivia with strong, exasperated teacher on Zoom energy." Three very funny and insightful hosts. If you're not subscribed to this podcast, you're missing out.
Oh, that's very good. Thank you very much for editing that, by the way. I'll happily fill in the gap. That's so kind of you. Chris has done a real solid for me there, because the actual review says, "Alex Zane on his return since 2011 is a tour de force because of fucking Wikipedia."
Oh.
Yeah, I was protecting you.
Transparency is the name of the game here. We're all very honest. It's a very authentic podcast. Yeah, because someone's clearly gone, "Oh, well, I wonder what Alex was doing last." And because, as I go on about, my Wikipedia page is locked. I cannot change it. And whoever controls my Wikipedia controls Arrakis. Whoever controls my Wikipedia has clearly decided, I'm not going to update it, but I'm not going to let anyone else update it. So it says that basically I retired in 2011.
Took all your money.
I mean, it's not a bad thing. It sounds like, wow, he's doing this for fun.
Ruchi must have paid a lot of money. He hasn't worked since.
Ruchi, which was still going in 2017, so still wrong. Anyway, thank you, Chris. That was a really nice thing you did. Right then, here are a few comments from our dear Clash Podders on Temple of Doom. I'll start us off. Thank you for everyone who messaged us. We are show@clashpod.com or indeed on Twitter @clashpod and Instagram @clashpod. Peter Stirrup says, unpopular opinion, but Temple of Doom was always my favourite as a kid and the one me and the family seemed to watch over and over again. I love how from the Bond-style opening, it never really stops. It's indie falling, sometimes literally, from one adventure to the next. Some of the shots of Harrison Ford in that film are absolutely iconic.
I've got something from Tom Forsyth, which says, my overriding memory of watching an Indiana Jones film is the one my mother always shares with anyone new I've met. Good mum. The one where I'm 5 years old and climbing the back of the sofa out of terror as we are watching a man's heart get ripped out and people getting crushed by rocks and stuff. It may be the most scared I've ever been.
Lara Jane Jackson is a big Raiders fan. She says, Raiders all the way. Marin is my idol and still smash a glass on the table like her drinking competition. But my best memory was a 7-year-old cinema Temple of Doom watch. Hand going fully into the chest, pulling heart out. Amazing. Then it got cut. Thought I'd imagined it for years.
We'll talk about that. Foob says 2, 3, 1, 4. That is the order Foob is going with, which means Temple of Doom is Foob's number one. Foob says, I'll never not love Temple. Has all the best set pieces, short round, bugs, and chilled monkey brains.
And Chris Little says the order is actually 1, 3, 2, 4. But my favourite memory was watching Temple of Doom on BBC One, Christmas Day, 1987. I was 4 years old and thinking that this was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. My nan, who was staying with us, then wrote a letter to the BBC complaining about the violence.
Hilarious.
That's the one I think I saw. I think that's my first Indiana Jones experience.
Yeah. That would make sense for me at the time. Yeah.
Not for me.
Okay. Nah.
Old man Tilly.
No, I have an anecdote, but have we got to that bit yet?
No, we haven't got to that bit yet. I'll do the synopsis first. So on Monday, Vicky raided a lost ark, and today I'm templing all over some doom. Let me take you on a journey. After Indy gets on the wrong plane out of Shanghai, he ends up in India with a screaming woman, where he's mistaken for some kind of god by villagers whose magic rock has been stolen. So Indy hotfoots it to Pankot Palace on the trail of fortune and glory, kid. Fortune and glory. After enjoying a culturally insensitive meal, he then descends into the Temple of Doom, where awaits him a series of iconic movie scenes, including a floor of bugs, a minecart chase, and a screaming woman. Emerging into daylight, Indy is faced with two swordsmen and deploys an iconic gag of reaching for his missing gun, something he won't realise is funny till the following year when he's in Egypt. After making sure every child watching is forever scared of rope bridges, Indy returns the villager's stone and finally stops Willy screaming by putting his tongue in her mouth. The end. Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, Temple of Doom.
That's such a good point about the gun.
It's in, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he plays it like...
He went, I've done that before.
Yeah. Just crazy.
Yeah, but were you aware that it was a prequel at that young age that you watched it? No. Mate, it was just the new installment, so...
No, absolutely not. But now, with that knowledge, you're like, why is he doing that face like, uh-oh?
What am I like?
Yeah. He doesn't know yet. You don't know. So, histories with this movie. I'll start. As I said on Monday, this was the definitive indie movie from my childhood. It's certainly the one I remember most vividly because I think it has moments that really play to a younger audience, which sounds weird when we talk about the response that it got about being too dark. But for me, I mean, the monkey brains and snake surprise banquet, I remember that distinctly as a kid as being this amazing gross out moment. The minecart chase. I mean, in all honesty, I think it was Peter Stirrup who just said it in that tweet. It's the one with the most iconic moments. Genuinely, if you distill them all down, this has the best, most memorable set pieces. At least that's how I felt growing up. But my lasting memory is being in the playground at school, and every time someone put their hand on your chest, going, Kalama, Shakti Day, you were obliged to go, Om Namah Shiva, Om Namah Shiva, Om Namah Shiva. That just happened every day.
That chant, that chanting is burned into my brain.
Yeah. Chris?
Yeah, I watched it on video a lot, so I would have seen it before that Christmas Day screening. So I remember just the wall of Indiana Jones Temple of Doom in my local video shop, and I rented it so often. And I think I've said before, I got to know the guy that ran the video shop quite well. He got us tickets to a screening of Goonies for my family early around that period. He gave me the Indiana Jones the Temple of Doom standee that was in the front window. Yeah, I can remember they had three in the window that Christmas. It was Rocky IV, Indiana Jones the Temple of Doom, and Back to the Future. And because I kept renting Indy, he gave me the Indy one, and I kind of wish he'd given me the Back to the Future one in hindsight, but at the time I was pretty happy with it. And that, yeah, that was in my living room for a good 10 years.
Wow.
Which is why I was a virgin for quite a long time.
Until the right time. Yes, yeah, don't
exactly.
worry about
still,
it.
Everything happens at the right time.
Still waiting.
But when she arrives,
hopefully this podcast will sort me out.
All you need to do, apparently, is just whip her off her feet, quite literally with a whip. That seems to work.
It would work. What? Shut up.
If you're Harrison Ford.
Wait, remember where I am, who I am. Yeah. That wouldn't work.
I love it, though.
Yeah. Context is everything. I'm the same. I remember, this is the one I've seen the most. This was the one that was, if you asked Child Me, which is my favourite, it's this one. Yeah, for everything you said, all those iconic moments. And I think, looking back on it, it's obvious, but I think the reason we all identified the most with it is the humour is very childish, which is, I mean that in a respectful way. And because of Short Round, you're in the film. So it's much easier to identify with all this grown-up stuff going on.
Yep. Exactly.
For sure.
Yep.
For sure. Which again is why I think it got a lot of stick, because it is kind of a kid's movie, but also has some truly horrific moments.
It's a very strange juxtaposition.
Yeah.
So would you like to know a little bit about this movie?
Mm. Yes, I would.
And by a little bit, I mean probably too much.
Just a little bit. Yeah, it's fine.
Well, it's all right. It's done now. Spielberg, basically, he says that when George Lucas first approached him for Raiders of the Lost Ark, he asked him to do all three movies. And George Lucas said, I have three stories lined up. Steven Spielberg then says, it turns out George didn't have any more stories, so we had to make them up. The ideas for this movie were numerous before they settled on what we have as Temple of Doom. There was a lost world pastiche with a hidden valley inhabited by dinosaurs. There was a Scottish castle that was haunted, which for some reason really interests me. The idea of Indy in a Scottish castle that was haunted. Steven Spielberg said, I'd just done Poltergeist. I didn't feel like I wanted to do that again. So we ended up with this demonic temple in India. It was Lucas who came up with this religious cult devoted to child slavery and black magic and ritual human sacrifice. They approached Lawrence Kasdan once again to write it. Lawrence Kasdan says very candidly, I did not want to be associated with Temple of Doom. I thought it was horrible. It's so mean. There's nothing pleasant about it. I think Temple of Doom represents a chaotic period in both theirs, Lucas and Spielberg's, lives, and the movie is very ugly and mean-spirited. So Lucas also talks about this in hindsight, about why this movie is so dark. And he says, I ended up being a lot darker. Part of it was I was going through a divorce at the time. Stephen the same. I wasn't in a good mood. And
Stephen wasn't going through a divorce.
And this is the thing.
That's just not true. Lucas is the one.
Yeah.
Lucas is the one. Spielberg was about to get married, weirdly, not to Kate Capshaw.
Mm.
He marries Amy Irving a year later.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's not true. But yeah, Lucas, yeah. He says I wasn't in a good mood. Wait, make a cheery film.
He marries Amy Irving a year later.
He does in 1985. He doesn't marry Kate Capshaw until 1991.
Oh.
Yeah, interesting.
My timeline is off on that. That is interesting. Mm. Yeah. I mean, Spielberg, basically, this has sort of entered the ether, like both him and George were in a terrible place. And Spielberg says, and I quote, I was not going through a divorce. I had just come off a huge success with E.T. I was in a good mood. So no Kasdan. In his place, we get the husband and wife team of William Hike and Gloria Katz, who'd worked with Lucas on American Graffiti and would work with him again soon on the incredible Howard the Duck.
We are going to do.
We have to do it. We have to do it. So, Stephen, I'm going to briefly tell this story because it's quite funny. They'd known Stephen from a while ago when he gave them a book about Thomas Crapper, who invented the flushing toilet, and said, write a treatment about this. I'll give it to my agent. We will get this made. And so they did. They gave it to Stephen, bumped into him a few weeks later, and they went, what's going on with that treatment that was definitely going to get made? And he said, I showed my agent, and he said, if that's the kind of film I want to make, he doesn't want to represent me. They also had a meeting with Stephen about another movie, which was when he approached them and said, what would happen if a spaceship landed on La Cienega? And it turned out that they said, we didn't really love that idea very much. And that's when he went on to make Close Encounters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But they did know a lot about India, which is why they got the job, they think. They were collectors of Indian art. So they do say, they told George, we know a lot of Indians, we've been there. I don't think they're going to think this movie is really cool. I think you might have trouble shooting there. And George was like, are you kidding? It's me and Steve. months later, they called and said, yeah, we can't shoot in India. They're really upset. We've got to go to Sri Lanka instead. We'll talk more about that as we go through. But the Indian government did find the script very offensive. So my favourite thing about showing Harrison Ford the scripts is they were a bit nervous whether he would like it or not. He read it and he loved it, although he did have a problem with a lot of short rounds lines. He was going through it and I quote, they say, he said, this line bothers me. The kid's supposed to be 10. I don't know if he'd say something like that. And we said, yeah, but he's a really cocky kid. And Harrison Ford wasn't having any of it. He was like, I don't know. It feels more like an indie line.
Okay.
And he basically went through the entire script and stole all Short Round's best lines for himself.
That's not cool, is it?
I don't know. I mean, Steven Spielberg says he was poaching all the 10-year-old's lines from the script. So in terms of the casting, Kate Capshaw said that George and Steven had been looking for the girl. And by the way, and as I go through this, Kate Capshaw is a soundbite machine. She is very candid about this movie. She says, Stephen was looking for the girl. And by the way, even while we were making the movie, they always referred to her as the girl. Harrison Ford was shown just one tape at Stephen's insistence. He was like, I've got 19 girls on tape. I'm going to show you one. It's Kate. And Harrison Ford went, yep, she's the one. So that's how Kate Capshaw gets the role. She says about the experience, I think we were constantly stretching and reaching to be as brilliant as the first one. And we just didn't have the story. We had children at risk. Where's the fun in that? There were also 100 more screams than we need. So I feel justified in my screaming woman opening because she talks about having to scream more than she'd anticipated in this film. And then we get onto Short Round. He turned up to the audition with his brother and they were like, we like you, not your brother. That's the way to break up a family. But he gets the role.
Yeah, it's adorable watching them do the screen test because he couldn't really speak much English, the actor. And so, yeah, they asked him to improvise a scene with Harrison Ford where he was accusing Indiana Jones of cheating at cards.
Yeah, that's
brilliant. You can watch it and it's just how it ended up in the movie.
It's
like,
so good.
He's just so natural.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reason that they made it a prequel finally is because they didn't want any Nazis again. They'd done Nazis, so that's why we had the thuggy cult.
Yeah, they would lose Nazis and Marion. They wanted a different woman, and so they would find it harder.
Because they wanted to turn it into Bond. Spielberg was like, it's a different girl for every film. So that's why Marion was out, despite a lot of people being disappointed in that with the finished film. And the writers got a lot of stick, and they were like, look, we were told that we had to bring a new girl in. So that's what we did.
Harrison Ford doesn't seem like he was that happy about it being a prequel. Because as he said, I'm 3 years older and Indiana Jones is supposed to be 2 years younger. So there's this 5 years differential that if you look at me, it ain't the same.
Yeah.
Right then. Any more on the backstory to this movie? Or do you want to go through it?
No, let's go for
it. Right.
Oh, the names. We're back with the names. Willie was named after Spielberg's dog and Short Round was named after the writer's dog.
Right.
So they continued the naming of characters after dogs.
You're not allowed to work on Indiana Jones if you don't have a dog. Is that right?
Yeah.
But it made me think, why would you call a dog Short Round? Is that
because it's short?
It's named after a character in a movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
What movie?
Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom.
Oh, it makes sense.
No, it's another previous movie. I cannot remember what it's called. I can go through my notes, but
please
it's really...
Please don't.
I'm not going to. I said I could go through my notes.
Please don't.
I'm not going to. So We are once again having the Paramount logo turn into something special. This time a mountain on a giant gong. It's sick. I love it. We are in Shanghai in 1935, a year earlier than the events of Raiders of the Lost Ark in Club Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
It's nice. Mm. No?
It's fine.
It's fine. All right. So George basically said to Stephen, let's do a big musical number. You've always wanted to direct a musical number. I absolutely adore the opening of this film, and I adore the musical number. I really like Anything Goes as a song anyway, but the fact Kate Capshaw sings it in Mandarin, this is the version that I have on my iTunes.
Okay.
I listen to this a lot.
I think the actual musical number goes on too long.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased that Steven Spielberg wanted to make a musical and got to do his musical scene, but as an Indiana Jones fan, I didn't sign up for that much dancing.
This is the first time I've thought about it, that say you're in the timeline and you go and see Raiders in 81 and you love it and you're like, oh my God, there's a sequel. And then it opens with a full dance number. Mm. Would you have been a bit surprised?
I remember thinking this was great as a kid. I was like, wow, this is weird. And then I loved tap dancing as a kid. I've told you this before. Yeah. I wanted to be a tap dancer.
I thought of you when I was watching it.
It's a great bit of tap. And I love the reverse splits as well when they go back up. The reversing of the film.
You like tap dancing like Kathleen Kennedy, who's in the sequence as one of the dancers.
Is she?
Yeah.
Is she really?
She really is,
I didn't know that.
Yep. I bet they didn't call her the girl. Excuse me.
Boss. This whole sequence around the table, weirdly, with Lao She and the table and the diamond and the antidote and the poison, I think I was most impressed as a kid because I'd never seen a table that had a spinning wheel on it. And that blew my mind, the fact that you could put something down on one side of the table and spin it and it goes around to the other person. This really impressed me because I'd never seen it before. I remember being very upset at David Yip, Indy's associate, getting shot. That really upset me as a kid because he seems like in about 3 seconds, he seems like the most likable character in the movie.
And he's set up to be the sidekick.
Yeah, we learned that he's been gone on all those adventures with him. I want to see one.
Yeah.
And what a line. I go first, Indy. Yeah. It's like, oh.
But as Vicky said in the last episode, this is Indiana Jones dressed as Bond.
Yep, full Bond.
Going full Bond. He does look very debonair and glamorous.
Although James Bond wouldn't drink that drink because it's obviously got something wrong with it, because it's just appeared out of nowhere and he's like, I'll be having that. James Bond wouldn't do that.
Yes, I mean, I feel like he does a couple of things in this scene that don't feel like it's the same Indiana Jones we saw before.
He punches a drinks girl. Did you see that?
He punches a woman, but he takes Willy hostage as well, and she's not done anything wrong. So it does feel like, oh, it's slightly different Indy. Yeah.
But this is supposed to be a different Indy. What the writers say is that they get a lot of stick for Willy being a very different kind of girl, but no one seems to notice that this is meant to be a different period in Indy's life, and he's a very different Indy in the sense that he hasn't yet got the experience. And by the end, when he saves the kids, that turns him into the Indy that we see in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay.
Fair enough, yeah, because he's very much not selling to a museum here. He's selling to a gangster.
Yeah.
Well, that's why he says in the middle of it, fortune and glory, kid, fortune and glory, because that is all he's interested at this point in his life.
Sounds a bit like Han Solo.
I'm really worried about him being like a Professor Solo character. The guy gets a skewer in his chest, so we immediately know this is a grown-up movie for kids, because that's a hell of a way to go. Fried food on a skewer in your chest. I love the whole thing. I love the crawling around the floor, the ice falling over, and the diamond going missing in it. It's just a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, and they talked about it wanting to be... They start the film with the end of The Last Adventure, and that's very much what they've done here.
Yes.
How do you mean?
You're watching the end of some other story. This doesn't really connect with what's in this story. So it's like you're watching
with Raiders. Like you're picking up the serial element.
You're watching the climax of a different movie, which I guess Bond does as well. Mm-hmm. But,
Then we get the car chase through the streets of Shanghai. We first get to know a little more about Willy when Indy passes her his gun and she drops it out the window and goes, I burnt my fingers and I cracked a nail. That's Willy. This is Willy who we're dealing with right now. I don't know why Lao She is chasing Indy at this point. I can't work it out. He's got what he wanted.
Yeah.
The ancestral thing. He doesn't know that Indy has the diamond. The diamond went missing in the club. So it's unclear to me why Lao She is insisting on finishing off Indy at this point.
Well, does he want to kill him because he knows that Indy... He's going to kill him back because he's tried to kill him, if you see what I mean.
I do.
Maybe, yeah. Indy somehow ends up on Lao She's plane, which even Lao She seems surprised about. I really wish it, when Indy turns around and goes, you know, not this time, Lao She.
Nice try, Lao She.
I wish he showed him the diamond. To me, that would be a victory at the end of this scene and would explain the chase as opposed to, you know, the way it ends up. But nevertheless, we have the pilots bailing out of the plane and we have a very short reprieve where Indy is asleep.
Because he doesn't wake up then. So you were talking about he's got like this sixth sense that he can sense trouble.
Prequel though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
He hasn't developed it yet.
I don't think he does have a sixth sense. Short Round says, call him Dr. Jones. And then she says, Dr. Jones, wake up, please. It's the Aqua song.
Yes, it is.
It's from this scene.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
Which I actually have the single of that. I do like that Aqua song.
Do you?
But yeah, I didn't realise it was directly quoting from a specific scene.
Can you sing? No, go on. No, don't.
Jones, why do you like that
Jones
song?
Calling Dr. Jones. It was less annoying than Barbie Girl.
Wake up now. Is it because you look a little bit like Ken from the band Aqua?
I don't think I do.
A little bit. Let's just get this out of the way because we're going to hear Willie screaming a lot. Now, Kate Capshaw says, I didn't read the parts where Willie has to scream. I didn't know how to scream, so Stephen taught me how to scream. Screaming...
I bet he did.
...is not...
Naughty. Oh. Wow.
Not until 1991. But, oh.
Nothing happened before then.
What? So, I did a little digging around this, and apparently... Stephen sort of started to see how dark this movie was getting. And so he really encouraged the screaming. Like the screaming wasn't in the original script. And actually it moved her character away from what it was on the page because he wanted to try and offset the darkness that he realized they were shooting by having her screaming a lot. And so that's why she turned into that character. And I couldn't for the life of me find the quote, but I remember years ago reading an article where Steven Spielberg does acknowledge, he says, this isn't the way I would have a female character in a movie anymore. This was a mistake.
But child me thought it was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she does do that job. She does undercut all the darkness and make it palatable for kids.
She's very upset about it. I mean, she said she was a feminist. She was a single mum doing a job, getting on with her life, and she felt like she was a feminist and she was attacked from all quarters. She said, I don't think there was a good review. I was blindsided by it. The thing that surprised me the most was that the critics, women critics in particular, were very critical of Willie Scott as if we were making a political statement and I was doing nothing for my sisters. Mm. And her argument is that Willie does fall back on her own resources as the film goes on and she becomes a strong, gutsy lady, which there is an element of that as the film goes on, but... Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that it's compared to Marion as well.
Yeah, who's like super capable. And
we'd come through this period as well of I think we did have the, although the women weren't the leads of these films, between Lois Lane, Princess Leia and Marion, you had these really tough, resourceful women who could stick up for themselves and they didn't need these men to protect them. And so it's a shame that it feels like we've gone backwards with this movie, which they have literally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this first 20 minutes is a proper roller coaster. We've gone from poison, bar fight, car chase, to a plane crash, to a sledging dinghy, whitewater rafting. It's nuts and it's utterly brilliant. This whole opening 20 minutes is unbelievable. Do you remember being utterly blown away by the fact that they parachute out of a plane using a dinghy?
I was like, why has no one thought of that before? Because it obviously works.
Obviously works.
Yeah.
Well, I actually found out whether it would work or not.
It can't.
Because obviously someone has gone, let's find out if this stunt would really work and you'd survive. You would have, based on the height the plane was, the speed that they were travelling at when they hit the ground, the fact that there's snow on the ground and it's a slope, so you'd get some forward momentum, they would have a 15% chance of survival.
Okay.
So it would actually work. If you balanced your weight successfully in that dinghy and positioned yourself so it didn't flip over, you could potentially survive that.
And like lots of the stuff in this film, that is from the original Raiders story conference. That was an idea that they had in 1978, couldn't use in the first film. And it's amazing how much they continue to be used in these films from that three-day conversation.
Yeah, if you want to know where it would be in the Raiders film, this was when he's flying into Nepal, the Nazis sabotage the plane, and he actually uses dinghy to land on a mountainside and slides right up to Marion's bar and gets out of the dinghy. So that's where it would have been in Raiders. So, Indy arrives in a village. Someone has stolen their Sankara stone. These are the MacGuffin for the movie. They had the Arkhan Raiders, and now we have the five Sankara stones. One has been stolen from this village, and two stones are found beneath Pankot Palace. There's a loose connection to the Hindu religion here. They have stones called the Sivanlinga, the symbol of the Hindu god Shiva. Lucas says of the Sankara stones that he feels they were too esoteric now. I quite like the stones, but I do think we have gone down a level in jeopardy in this film. It feels like a much smaller, self-contained adventure.
Yeah.
The writers said that the Nazis getting their hands on the thing, the Ark in Raiders, was about world domination. The world's fate was at stake. And so they talked a lot about how to try and beef up the Sankara stones and turn it into a much more global threat. Which is why later on you find Molaram going with these stones, all the other religions will fall. It never worked for me.
And it doesn't get around the fact that we do go underground and then don't come up till the end of the movie. So we're not having that globe-trotting adventure that the first one was and that Bond is and that kind of you expect to see these glamorous locations.
Which, to quote Steven Spielberg, he feels the movie is too subterranean. In hindsight, he feels we do spend too much time underground. I actually like that. We'll get on to that. So Indy is welcomed into the village as a proper white saviour.
Yeah.
I mean, and no mistake, they try and touch him.
Yeah.
They bring him offerings, food that they haven't eaten for a week themselves. They put on a plate to give to him. It's insane.
Yeah, it's bad.
Living in the past or the future. Willie is massively rude about their food and embarrasses Indy. So as well as being scared and screamy, she can also be culturally insensitive.
Yep. But it is problematic. And obviously the banquet is more problematic because if it was food, like the food doesn't look good, no. As in it looks like shit. It looks like whatever. So you're the audience. You are with Willie because you're like, oh, yuck. And that's the problem. You're not with Indiana Jones being, this is rude. You're like, yeah, I wouldn't eat it either, etc. And so that's the problem. You're meant to be laughing at these people.
Yeah.
Well, that's not what Roshan Seth says.
Are we talking about the banquet?
Yeah.
We're not there yet. Because on page 25...
Vicky was talking about the banquet, yeah, definitely.
Well, she was talking about the banquet, but we'll get into the banquet in a minute. We've got giant vampire bats first.
Cool.
Indy gets his mission. Perfect timing. Go to Pankot Palace. Get the stone. They actually say, go to Pankot Palace, get the stone, bring it back here. It's as simple as that. It's like, that is your mission for this movie.
Yeah.
It's like, there's, you know, no smoke and mirrors. Say it directly. That is it. Although they do add a little soup sonas. All the kids have been stolen as well. Open with that. I mean, I understand that religion is a big deal, but fucking hell, your kids have been stolen.
It's very quiet around here. Oh, God, shit. Yeah, the kids have gone, actually.
But they make a point of sort of going, you know, get the stone. If you got time, grab the kids as well. I mean, how do I make this clear? Stone first, then kids. If on your way out and you've got the stone, you pass the kids and it's not out of your way, grab them, but absolutely get the stone. That is the priority here. We can do without the kids. So we're off to Pankot Palace. I thought the elephants were the best thing in the world as a kid. I don't think I'd ever seen an elephant in a movie before.
Yeah, I think brilliant. It's all hilarious.
It's so much fun. Willie now brings out the big guns. She needs to call her agent. And giant vampire bats. This movie is responsible for me thinking giant vampire bats existed.
Yeah, vampire bats exist, but they're tiny.
They're tiny, the size of your hand.
Quite cute, yeah.
They're really, really sweet, yeah. Giant vampire bats went extinct 300 years ago and only lived in South America. This is what I spent my time doing on the internet. Willie screams at a bat, a monkey, a lizard, an owl, another lizard in one incredible montage. And then we do get to Pankot Palace and we meet Chatterlal, who you just mentioning, played by Roshan Seth, the Prime Minister to the Maharaja, and Captain Bloomberg of the British Army, played by Philip Stone, a.k.a. Delbert Grady from The Shining, which is amazing.
Also in Flash Gordon.
Who is he in Flash Gordon?
He's the High Priest at the end.
Oh, yeah!
Oh, my God. I can't believe I didn't recognise him in that. So, we get a little bit of exposition now from Captain Bloomberg about the bad guys in the movie, the thuggy cultists, or as he describes them, the thuggy cult was an obscenity that worshipped Kali with human sacrifice. They are a real thing.
Okay.
Do you know anything about the thuggies?
No.
It's really quite interesting. You'll bloody love this. So they were around in the 19th century in India. Historically, in terms of where they came from, it's suggested they were formed because the Indian armies were disbanded due to British rule. And mm-hmm. so they formed these groups of thugs to survive and robbed people. But contemporary scholarship is increasingly skeptical of the thuggy concept at all and has questioned the existence of such a phenomenon, which has led historians to describe the thuggy as an invention of the British colonial regime.
Mm. That would make sense.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Create an invisible enemy.
A pretend enemy.
So when you said they did exist, do you mean they didn't exist?
It's up for debate. Mm. It's up for debate. Join me on my new podcast.
British colonial rule.
Knowing our track record, I'm feeling like maybe they did not exist.
So yeah, the banquet scene. Hilarious as a kid.
Yeah, really, really, really funny.
Absolutely brilliant. Snake surprise, live eels coming out.
Yeah.
Genuinely, though, it is certainly responsible for misinforming kids of what might have gone on. Maybe not in the contemporary world. Maybe I didn't think, oh, in India, they're eating that right now. But I certainly think this would have been on the menu at some point in India, which genuinely is the power of film.
Yeah.
And you do have a responsibility, because I think as a kid, I was like, shit, they eat live eels out there.
Yeah, it's bad. It's othering and for a laugh. And it when you're a kid, it totally connects, because everyone in the playground was obsessed with it, like especially like the chilled monkey brains, like to serve it in the monkey's head and all the rest of it. And Willy faints and falls off her chair, and it's like this big comedy, physical comedy moment. And it is irresponsible, because you're only little and you think, well, fuck, like, yeah, they must definitely have eaten that shit.
Yeah, it really is. And the bit that you're talking about, I think it's this quote from Roshan Seth, where this sounds like hindsight. I don't know when this quote is from, but I think it's much later than the movie. He says the banquet scene was a joke that went wrong. I got a great deal of flack for it because people kept saying, how does an intelligent man like you agree to be in a film which shows Indians dining on beetles and eels? He then says Stephen intended it as a joke, the joke being that Indians were so fucking smart that they knew all Westerners think that Indians eat cockroaches, so they serve them what they expected. The joke was too subtle for the film. I call bollocks on that. That sounds like something that in hindsight you'd say, because there are more Indians sitting around that table than there are Westerners.
Yes.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I don't buy it. I don't buy it, because they wouldn't be tucking into the food.
No. But we get beetle hors d'oeuvres, snake surprise, eyeball soup, and for dessert, chilled monkey brains. Again, as a kid, just amazing.
A lot of custard, apparently. A lot of custard, some raspberry jelly. That's what was going on in these scenes.
Oh, lovely.
Mm.
I didn't like the Maharaja having such a high-pitched voice.
Okay.
Wasn't it Dave Berry when he was on our show who said that's not his actual voice, though? He was dubbed.
It's the woman who voiced Ralph in The Muppet Babies doing his voice.
Muppet Babies, yeah. We do the things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we meet the Maharaja, as you said, a little kid who, as a little kid watching this, I learned to hate a lot. I hated that Maharaja.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
He was like poison to me. You did forgive him by the end. You're like, oh, thank God. But like,
it's because these things were happening at our level, because we had Short Round, who was our hero, and we had a kid villain as well. And it was cool that they got to fight each other even by the end of or Short Round kicks the crap out of him. But it's, that is why it's this weird combination of adult and kid in this film.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue with our weird combination right after this break.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, comedy scene, a little bit of light relief. Will Willie and Indy get it on? No, they won't. But I remember enjoying this as a child. It was like, you know, the 5 minutes thing, the repetition.
Yeah, I had no idea what they were talking about, obviously.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But I think she does such a good job. Like, when they're going to kiss each other and she lifts her head up, she's so good at, like, I will let you take the piss out of me, which I think is, and because you're laughing at her again, really mercilessly. Like, what does she say? She's like, oh, I could be the best you've ever had. And he just walks off or whatever. And she looks like an idiot in that moment. But then she pulls it back because she doesn't crumble with humiliation. She just, you know, meets him where he is. He's like, you'll be back in 5 minutes. She's really good.
And I think he would have been back in 5 minutes.
Well, he is at the end, isn't he? He's trying to get to her. Like, he goes, you know, he's the one who crumbles first, but then he ends up in the fight with the guy.
Also, if she'd have gone into his room, there's a kid in the room. Like, what's the Short Round is sleeping in his room.
Short Round's very mature.
What?
He asked Indy for full details, didn't he?
Yeah, that's weird, actually. I forgot about
that. And photos.
What? I mean, I've said it before on this podcast, but what was it in the mid-80s with middle-aged men and children hanging out together?
Yeah.
You've got Indian Short Round, you've got Mr. Miyagi and Daniel LaRusso, you've got Doc Brown and Martin McFly. Why were they all best mates? I get the kid got this mental father figure, but why do all these middle-aged men want to hang out with these children?
Yeah, and you're right. When he says full details, they should be like, okay, listen, we're going to talk about why that's not appropriate.
No time for love, Dr. Jones.
and then we enter the Temple of Doom. Indy pushes a female statue using the breasts. Willie feels uncomfortable out doing the same moments later in a very strange moment.
She's like, yeah, I understand why she would get the flack, and I think it's unfair. But in terms of from a feminist perspective, she's not going to have a problem touching some stone boobs. To make her squeamish about that is really unfair.
I think so too. Bugs. This is the moment that, for me, outdoes the snakes in the Well of Souls.
But also, is there not an element of we did bugs in the last film? We did them quite well at the beginning and then later on in the film with the snakes. And it just feels like a bit of a retread, which I think a few moments in this film feel like that to me.
I do not think these are different bugs, because we got the tarantulas at the start of Raiders, but these are bugs that I'd never seen before. Mm. And they're real bugs. I you know, they're big bugs. Like Kate Capshaw says about the bugs were much that's Frank. The worst part was having large bugs placed strategically on me where you can literally feel all their legs grip you.
Oh,
well, she took a relaxant to sedate herself.
Yeah, I'd have to be unconscious.
Pop There's a few valves. No,
yeah. Double drop a couple of them, yep. Get in there. Just when she turns her hand, we said this in the pub, like, it's so silly that I would fixate on that, but I'm not brilliant with bugs. Like, I think I can handle, loads of cockroaches, but those big things, like, walking around, like, when she turns her hand on, she says, oh, I broke a nail, and there's, like, what is that, like a mantis or something that's, like, the size of her hand?
I know the one where you see a centipede go under her hair. That's a dummy
you
wearing
can tell.
A wig.
Yeah,
but also that is a giant centipede whose bite has been known to kill people. So that is a dangerous, massive insect.
Yeah.
Do you not believe me?
I do. I'm just making me feel sick.
Last last night. So I was talking to someone from work and he said he went to a cave somewhere and it's called like the Cave of Doom. And it's full of like guano and bugs and cockroaches that live on the guano and all the rest of it. And he was on this tour. And then the tour guide was like, oh, sorry, forgot to mention. Obviously, watch out for the cockroaches. Don't slip on the poo, all the rest of it. But forgot to say, there are jumping centipedes in here also.
Oh my gosh.
And they're venomous. And they will make you really ill or die if they bite you. So just if you do feel something land on you, brush it away because they jump off the ceiling.
I hate to say it, but I feel like the power of this scene has been lessened since I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here started, because worse stuff happens to them, and that's like a game show on the telly.
I can't believe there are people in the world who will do it. Like, when she won't put her hand in the thing, obviously you don't want to put your hand in there. You've got to save your man and all the rest of it. But she's like, oh, and it's like, that's so understandable. Then you watch I'm a Celebrity and they're like, fuck it, I'll do it. And it's like, that's mad
apart
to
from
me.
Was it Paul Burrell? He didn't like doing it.
Didn't Gillian McKeith pass out rather than do it?
We should be doing a podcast about that.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid though, this was immense. Just it was the floor. It was them walking on it. It was like there being
and
no
she hasn't
escape.
Got, I don't think she's got shoes
that
on.
That fucked me up. The, yeah.
But I also felt like the ceiling coming down on them with the spikes, and his performance was reminding me quite a bit of Han Solo in the trash compactor in Star Wars. Felt like, oh, I've seen this scene before. I've seen him doing, and he's very good at it.
Yep.
I mean, there's no one better in peril than Harrison Ford. Yeah. But
That is Steven Spielberg's favourite scene in the whole movie, The Room of Spikes, which I think is kind of interesting. But he loves it, and I love it because it is the best face acting in the history of cinema.
Yeah, it's very good.
We are going to die.
It is astonishing.
So why, if you're going to set up traps in your house,
yes.
Why do you make them slow moving?
Yeah, it's very slow moving.
So let's get to the thuggy ceremony, as seen in Young Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to be completely honest with you now. This blew my mind watching this at the weekend because I have never, ever seen this version. I have never,
you never
seen
saw the heart.
I've seen the heart, but I've never seen the fingers go through the chest and remove the heart. I've only ever seen the edited version where he puts his hand on the chest and then it cuts to him holding the heart.
Okay.
I've never seen them pass through because that was cut. That was the one thing that they cut from the original.
I don't think I'd seen the chest kind of heals up itself.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd seen that shot before. But I think there must be a few different versions of this floating around. I was watching the Amazon Prime one.
Yeah, that's what I was watching.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, I agree. There was stuff I hadn't seen
before.
That
had a lot more in it than I've ever seen before.
Okay.
Show me everything. So that was great. But yeah, this was the thing that got them into a lot of trouble. Kathleen Kennedy says the yanking out of the heart was the one thing that put us over the edge. This was the same year that we made Gremlins and put the Mogwai in the microwave. It's a great
less messed up than this, though. It really is. It's a lot. I don't think it all needs to be there.
I think for the man that's in the cage, it works because he goes from being, to my adult reading, from being scared and not quite into it to understanding that he's about to have a very, like, a supernatural religious experience because his heart has been removed and he's still with us.
Yep.
So he knows that when he gets lowered into that fire pit, he's going to go wherever he was promised. And that's the look on his face.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the concept is enough. I'm saying, just didn't think it needed to be as graphic as it is.
Okay. I like it.
I think you can see his hand going towards the chest, and then I think you can see him holding the friggin'
heart.
Which
is the version I'd see.
Yeah, and that works for me, and it probably might have been better for me at 7.
Yeah.
It certainly worked for me because that's the version I saw as a kid, and I still was like, that is possibly the most memorable scene. And it's just an incredible thing. I'd never seen the whole idea still amazes me, the idea that he can remove the heart. Well, actually, yeah. It's better that you don't see his fingers go in because it implies some kind of supernatural power, the fact that he's just pulled it out and it's transported out of the man. I really like that scene. And I do like Molaram. What are your thoughts on Molaram? Amish Puri, an Indian actor who Roshan Seth describes as a very nice guy. He was operatic. He couldn't have been a better villain. But I have to say this, Indian people are very embarrassed when they see one of their own playing roles like that.
Okay. I think he has a lot of presence and a lot of gravitas, and he did scare me when I was younger. But I think it's a shame. Is he the person on the bridge at the end that Indiana Jones makes him punch himself in the face?
Yeah.
So that undercuts all of like the big presence, because obviously as a kid you're like, ha, why are you punching yourself? Why are you punching yourself?
I feel like he's almost an afterthought as a villain, though, in the way that with Raiders, the two villains were so much a part of the story. Mm. We don't really get a sense of who this guy is beyond he's just pure evil.
Yeah.
But I don't think they spent a lot of time on him.
Well, you're in agreement with Kate Capshaw, who said in 2008, I think, there's nothing like a Nazi for a bad guy. We didn't have a great bad guy. Very candid again. I personally, Molaram is a better villain for me than anyone in Raiders. I think Tot, the leather-clad Nazi in Raiders, is good, but he sort of...
Well, he's a good henchman. I think Belloc's your villain, and I think Tot is a cracking henchman because he's clever, he's capable, and he likes pain.
Right.
And that's given you a lot of character traits, whereas I don't think we're given much with Molaram. Mm.
Well, not, but for me, he's better than Belloc, because Belloc I have some sympathy with. He seems like a guy who's got caught up in something because of his passion for archaeology, and that's led him down this terrible path of trying to open an ark and being in league with the Nazis. But he does it. He's not a villain, whereas Molaram's entire motivation is bad. He wants to destroy the world with his followers of Carly. So he's a villain in the purer sense.
Mm.
And I do think he's got some character traits. I think the bit that strikes me that I didn't realise before is when things go bad for him, when he's losing the fight and he's got that secret hatch that he just rolls through.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think really plays into this idea of him being a bit of a coward. And when things are going against him, he's going to run out of there.
Mm.
Because later on the bridge, he's quite happy to sort of throw his henchmen, his followers, to their death in an attempt to kill Indy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you look for it, there's a bit more depth to Molaram than you'd think. But I really liked him as a villain. But again, a lot of this is nostalgia. I will say I love the geography of this movie. Steven Spielberg talks about it being too subterranean. For me, the fact that it starts nice in the palace, and you go down a level to the secret passage and down a level to the temple and down another level to the mines, this sort of like almost like a video game going further and further. Oh, it's great. I love that we don't come up for air. It's really good.
I didn't miss it. I did love the globetrotting element, but I don't miss it in this film so much. And like when the kids are freed, they're like disheveled, dirty, they're covered in soot and whatever, and they run across the banquet table and like they're these dirty little kids in this beautifully clean palace. It's brilliant.
I feel like it does become a little bit oppressive watching it now in these scenes, the drinking of the blood, the falling into the black sleep, this waking nightmare, and sort of the tortures happening in these sequences as well. It's just it's a lot, and it goes on for a long time in what is supposed to be fun.
A family film.
Yeah. So we learn about the blood of Carly and the black sleep of Carly Marr. And then we see it in action in literally the next scene, which is Indy going bad.
And that's when that's the first time I realised if you want someone to swallow something, you have to pinch their nose. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was just blown away by that when I was little. I was like, spit it out. But no, you can't, because someone's holding your nose.
I mean, the bit that got me and the bit that got a lot of complaints from people was the fact that he hit short round in this sequence. A lot of people, and we'll get to one of the reviews that I picked up, which is, you know, this was considered a bad thing. I think they're wrong. I think as a kid, it's amazing that he hits short round because you know how far he's gone.
It's a movie moment. If you're gonna turn your hero villainous, then you've got to go for it. Mm. Otherwise, it won't have the desired effect. Superman did the same thing, and they got it right with the original ones. You know,
yeah. And also the bit where he makes up and apologizes to Sean and they hug is a tearjerker of a moment,
and it's
because he's hit him.
Yeah, it's a proper apology. It's not like, oh, that wasn't me. So he just says, I'm properly sorry. Rather than like half-assed apologies to Marion and to Willie, there are no real apologies.
Yeah. Willie would have died or caught fire. It goes too close to the lava.
Yeah. Her whole skin would have melted off.
Yeah. She's just a little bit red when she comes up. She looks like she's been running. and then we get to the fight that you mentioned on Monday, where he fights Pat Roach again.
Yeah.
Who is now an Indian guard, the chief Indian guard Blood on the roller, great. Short round fighting the Maharaja simultaneously, lovely.
Yeah, that's so good. Because again, you're in it. Mm. Like, and when Short Round gets like a little mini whip in as well, so I mean, it's brutal.
And it is funny when Short Round's fighting for his life and India shouts over, quit fooling around with that kid.
So good.
Yeah. I'm not.
And then we get to question, the most iconic sequence in Indiana Jones history, the minecart chase.
I'd say the boulder is the most iconic, but okay. I'd go minecart.
I just
second.
Think this minecart chase is amazing because that's why I don't like the Raiders cliff edge chase as much, because I saw this first. Mm. And that to me is thrilling from start to end. There's so much going on. And this is such a silly little script thing, but when Indiana Jones says to Shorty, you drive, and it's like, we already know he can drive because we saw him drive before. And it's like, that's just a little touch. But you think, oh, that's fine. He's not going to be like, whoa, I can't do it. So there's other stuff going to happen.
Spielberg said critics kept saying that our films weren't movies, they were roller coasters. So we gave them one.
To be honest.
So we gave them one.
The reason I like it as much as I do is because I do love a mineshaft ride at a theme park.
Have you been to Disneyland in California where you can go on the Indiana Jones minecart ride?
No, I would like to.
It's
very
not
much.
As good as this. It's still quite good.
And of course, this was supposed to be in Raiders.
Yeah,
That's why that all is happening in a quarry.
So this right, was at the end. This was going to be. So after the Nazis had died when opening the Ark, Marion and Indy were going to load the Ark onto a minecart and escape at the end of Raiders. So that's where this would have fitted into Raiders, chased by apparently some surviving Nazis.
Okay.
So some Nazis survived. That's where it was going to be. Do you want to know what the best job in the world is? It is to be a sound mixer on Temple of Doom, who were required to go to Disneyland after it was closed and ride every roller coaster to collect sound effects for this sequence.
Oh my God, what a dream.
How did you feel about watching the stop motion aspects of this?
What were the miniature? What stop
motion? When you're seeing plasticine versions of the characters going over fire and you not clock them?
I only noticed the miniature stuff.
I didn't know
when the water comes, then it's obviously miniaturized. And it looks really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously it's a long time ago. But I didn't notice plasticine stuff.
Fair enough.
Okay. That's a great joke, though. Water.
Is it?
Again, best bit about the Raiders, cliff chases when he goes under, he does the stagecoach thing under the car, but there's not a mark on him. Mm. Like, no dust is what I mean. Mm. And this, his feet would have been gone. Like, you can't stop a metal wheel with your little shoes and just be like, oh, my feet are a bit hot. But it's fine. It's a kid's film.
And then we get I'm going to say it and then I'm going to take it back, I'm sure, by the end of next week when we're doing the verdict. But for me, separating nostalgia, this is such an iconic end visually to an Indiana Jones movie, more so than any of the others. Or maybe it was just because I was a kid. But that rope bridge and watching Indiana Jones, like, basically signal to Shorty to wrap his leg around the rope and he's going to cut a bridge in two. Just to be in that room where they come up with this and someone going, we're going to cut the bridge in two. And someone will have undoubtedly gone, don't be stupid. I don't know how you do that. And mm-hmm. then going, no, there is a way to do it. It feels like the idea that you were like right off because it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then to actually follow through and create it. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. And what's amazing about that sequence as well is it's a brilliant sequence and it was shot on three different continents. It was shot in Sri Lanka, in England and in America, all the different parts to pull it together.
So the alligators are from America.
Are they?
Yeah, the alligators are at Gator World or something. That's why they're not crocodiles, because they've got in. That was shot in Orlando. So I know that much about the alligators. Mm. Were shot by a third unit in Orlando.
Yeah, a lot of the close-ups were shot in England, and obviously the rope bridge was cut in Sri Lanka, which is spectacular. All these mechanical dummies. They had one shot.
They look good because they sort of sprinkle off. Mm. When the baddies are coming off the bridge, they look brilliant.
And they're moving. I would have thought I would just buy a dummy falling, but no, they wanted them to move. So their legs are flailing. Yeah. It's really clever.
It really is. And, you know, I mean, at this point, Willy being Willy is the perfect response, which is, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And Short Round, he no nuts, he crazy. Great. This is everything I want from a climax. The rope bridge goes down. Mole Ram becomes a self-serving evil dick where he's trying to dislodge his own henchmen to throw. He's throwing people at Indiana Jones. But if there's a downside to this, it's Indy's line where he's fighting Molaram and the stones have got hot and he says, "You betrayed Shiva." I'm a bit lost as to what's going on. I don't really understand what I understand that he's the thuggy cult is bad, but I'm not sure why he's betrayed Shiva.
Well, because he's taken all the children to for his evil ends. So that's not cool.
Minor miners. I mean, I understand that what he's done is wrong, but I think it's just I think it's quite a strange line. I don't think it's sort of been, I don't think enough of not the mythology, the religious aspect of what is the correct way to worship Shiva and what he has done differently is very clear.
Okay, that's fair.
So that's a little bit of a problem. But aside from that, you know, we're into the final thing now. Molaram gets eaten by alligators. And we're back to the village.
No, before that, though, we've got the British captain showing up.
Oh, yes.
In charge of an Indian army.
Yeah.
Colonialism is ultimately the saviour.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, when they go back to the village, they're in the same clothes they were wearing when they were in the village before they get to the palace. When they get to the palace, they all get changed. Mm-hmm. So did they take their clothes out of the mine with them? No, obviously they didn't. They just shot it. Mm. But no one's gone... Have you been carrying around that crisp white blazer this whole time?
Well, Willie has learnt to respect the culture of India now, though, because she bows on her return to the village. That's her arc complete.
Oh, it's bad.
She will definitely eat chilled monkey brains next time because she respects the culture of India. And also, it turns out she was just playing hard to get earlier. She just needed a man to whip her off her feet.
I think about
literally.
This all the time. Because, right, so if a stranger did that, let's just boil it down. If a stranger did that, that's fucking terrifying. Mm. That's an actual whip. I'm being kidnapped. This is not going to end very well. Mm. Between the two of them, is it still okay? Because they do know each other and they were kind of there, but she is walking away. So
it would fucking hurt, is the bottom line. It's like, it looks great, but you'd be like, ah! Oh! Oh! I mean, you know this is a fact because you were whipped earlier, Indy, so you know it hurts.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a complicated set of emotional responses for me to that. No, it's fine. It's fine. You can do that.
I mean, you compare the end of this, people gathering around, cheering, smiling, crowding Willy and Indy as they laugh and get sprayed with water.
Yeah.
Compare this ending to the ending of Raiders and you're like, this feels like ridiculously happy. It feels like the polar opposite of what we expect from an indie movie, which is something that leaves you going, ooh.
Yeah, I think
this is Scooby-Doo.
Well.
This is like everyone standing around laughing.
Yeah. Mm. They should have picked out a character, a parent who'd lost a child and made a bit more of a fuss of him or her at the beginning, then have them as an image to be, you know, you see families being reunited and it's very sweet and emotional, but it's very generic. It's just people we don't know lifting their kids up. So if we picked on a mom or a dad and then got a particular kid, it would be better.
To the point where I don't know if the right kids are being matched with the right parents at this point. I'm just like, are you just grabbing whichever kid cuts to you first? So I'll have this one. So that's it. That's pretty much the end. The reviews were not good for this movie, which is kind of astonishing.
Were you conscious of those reviews when you watched it? Because I wasn't. And so now they can't touch me because it's like, I don't care what people think. But
no, if anything, I'm the same. I'm like, these reviews make no sense to me. What was going on with people at this point in America that you suddenly took umbrage at this film? Is it bringing down a successful partnership like Lucas and Spielberg? Was there something else at play? I dug around and I couldn't find like any sort of movement that was going on that suddenly suggested that we needed to protect our children from these horrible movies. And by all accounts, kids loved it.
Yeah, of course.
And it's strange. Kate Capshaw says, I think you said this already, Chris, I don't think there was a good review. I found it odd that it was an action-adventure film and we were meant to be doing message work about, you know, she says, people were very critical of Willie Scott as if we were making a political statement and I was doing nothing for my sisters. Mm. One reviewer at the time said, the ads say, this is an actual review, the ads say this film may be too intense for younger children. They are fraudulent. No parent should allow a young child to see this traumatizing movie. It would be a cinematic form of child abuse. Even Harrison Ford is required to slap Kwan and abuse Capshaw. There are no heroes connected with the film, only two villains, and their names are Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
See, I don't remember any of this source. My parents were like, yeah, stick it on. Don't worry about it.
These were American reviews primarily. I don't think we had it quite as bad here because they cut a shit ton out of it right before they released
yeah
it.
Yeah, and we didn't change the rating system because of the film. Mm.
We don't love our children as much.
Yeah. So we want them to be scared as soon as possible.
I mean, for me, ideally, I did feel like it was on the edge of what I could have dealt with, like, mentally. Like, it is, as I said, it is. I guess it was the first horror film I ever saw.
I've never had a nightmare about Temple of Doom, though.
No.
I've had nightmares about fucking Poltergeist and things like that.
That's a horror film.
Yeah.
For adults, whereas this is a frigging family film aimed at kids, so that's the difference.
Yes, I see that.
It's Indiana Jones, so it's a kid's movie. As far as I was concerned, this was a hero of mine. This was a movie for me. And I think because you walk into that, you're just like, everything in this movie is completely acceptable for me.
And it'll be fine.
And anyway, the Nazis' fucking faces melting at the end of Raiders is worse than anything in this. I watch this and I see a kid's movie. I don't understand why people think this is, like, people talk about this being the darker movie.
Mm. Well, Spielberg certainly...
Yeah, well, Spielberg and Lucas in 1984 come out to defend it. And Spielberg says the story of that was I'd come under some criticism, personal criticism, for both Temple of Doom and, you know, Gremlins in the same year. This is a much later interview. I remember calling the head of the Motion Picture Association and suggesting to him we need a rating between R and PG, either 13 or 14, and they came up with PG-13, which is where that was born out of this movie.
Yeah, I said that, but the stuff he said more recently... I think he's changed his tune about it, hasn't he?
In 1989, he said, I wasn't happy with Temple of Doom at all. It was too dark, too subterranean, and much too horrific. I thought it out-poltered Poltergeist. There's not 1 ounce of my own personal feeling in Temple of Doom. That was 89. Have you got something more recent?
Yeah, Indy 2 will not go down in my pantheon as one of my prouder moments. I saw him say it's his least favourite of the Indiana Jones films. Mm. But conversely, it's his favourite because he said... Indiana kind of gets the girl at the end, but I really got the girl.
Oh, yeah. That's
and
nice.
And so for him, it's the most special film because it's how he met the love of his life.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. He says, we married years later, and that to me was the reason I was fated to make Temple of Doom.
And he does talk about the fact that there was a scene in the jungle where Willie's washing herself and a snake attacks her.
Yeah.
And the day she got to set, she lost her shit, basically, Kate Capshaw, and she felt like she couldn't do it. Mm. And Spielberg just said, you know what? We're not going to do it. I'm going to cut it out. And he said that he thinks years later that's why she married him, is that she was so grateful that he didn't make her do this scene that he says, I'm sure that's the reason.
So despite all the fucking outpouring of anger towards it, it was a huge movie. It was the third biggest movie in the US that year after Beverly Hills Cop at number one. And what at number two?
What year was it?
Ghostbusters.
Oh my God! The thing is, I always forget when Ghostbusters came out. Because I didn't, I was three. So I obviously didn't watch it when I was three.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, it came out when I saw it.
Yeah, Ghostbusters and Beverly Hills Cop. Then Temple of Doom. Right, should we do the bits?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, what's your best scene, Victoria?
The mine shaft chase, all of it from start to finish. I think it's brilliant. That's
okay,
it.
Chris?
Yeah, I don't love it as much now, but because of how it made me feel then, the mine shaft cart chase.
There are so many to choose from, but for me, it's the opening in Shanghai in Bar Obi-Wan. I just remember it so vividly. I love it.
Yeah.
Bit of tap dancing, bit of diamonds, bit of fighting, bit of gunfire, hiding behind a gong. Never seen that before. I'd never seen someone use a moving object to hide from machine gun fire as they move across the room.
Why would you?
It's quite specific.
No way. I think I've seen that a million times since then, but okay, this was my first. Who is your MVW, Chris?
Most valuable ever. So I'm going to go back to Unsung Heroes here, and we haven't even mentioned him today, but I am going to pick Mr. Vic Armstrong, because by this point, he was Indiana Jones' stunt double. He was doing an amazing job, but also Harrison Ford very badly injured his back riding the elephant, and he had to leave the set for a couple of weeks, and production would have shut down, and it would have been a disaster. Spielberg said the picture would have ground to a halt if Vic hadn't stepped forward. He stood in for Harrison and saved the picture from disaster. So we owe a lot of this to Vic Armstrong, and that's why there are quite a lot of scenes where Indiana Jones has his back to camera, because it ain't Harrison. And certainly the whole Pat Roach fight, the one you talked about where he gets dashed in the mining machine, that's entirely Vic Armstrong. So
okay,
yeah, well done, Vic.
Yeah, Spielberg says that he'd walked up to Vic Armstrong and got to about 5 feet away before he realised it wasn't Harrison Ford, and so he said to Vic Armstrong, "I'll just shoot you from 5 feet away." That was his way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think he said one of Harrison Ford's kids ran up to him and grabbed his hand, thinking that was his dad.
Whoa, that's mad.
Harrison Ford gave him a signed photograph of the two of them, or signed a photograph of the two of them after, I think it was this movie or the next movie. And he said, "If you learn to talk, I'm in real trouble." So that's yours. What's yours, Victoria? Your most valuable whatever?
Well, I was going to give it to Steven Spielberg, because when I think of, like, when you think of the Steven Spielberg film of your dreams, when I think of that, it's this, because of the way that Indiana Jones is shot, lit, framed, especially when he's in the hut, when Willie is rude about the food, like, it just looks pure Spielberg. It looks like my childhood there. And also, I think a lot of kudos to him for taking, you know, this, to some people, this sequel is better than the original. And what he's done is taking what worked, did it again, but tried something new. So the love interest is a very different type of woman, and he's got a sidekick. And I do admire, you know, like, we are going to honour what works, but we're also not afraid to try something new. But I think I'm going to give it to Kate Capshaw, because if I'd have watched this as a grown up, I would be like, that shrill is irritating, all the rest of it. But as a child, I thought she was so funny, and I can't watch it and not find her charming and funny and a lens on that world that you kind of need. Like, with Marion's amazing, but she's sort of as prepared for that world as Indiana Jones is. Whereas Willie is more like us, where you'd be like, fuck me, look at this place. It's horrendous. Yeah. No, I'm not putting my hand in there, obviously.
Yeah, which again, to go back to these reviews and the hard time she was given, it's kind of preposterous now, because when you look, I mean, not now, but then I watched it and I'm with you totally. She was like, you know, I loved it then. Now, not so much.
Yeah.
Well, my MVW, because I've worked this out, because you have to give it to him for one movie.
Yes.
And I know it's not going to be any of the others. So mine is Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. This is the movie that really introduced me to the character more than Raiders. And so if he's going to have one movie where he's the MVW, it's this one for me.
Okay.
Because it ain't the others. Well, finally, change. Victoria.
It's a back to Willie again. I don't think she does get a moment where she's toughened up and she gets to throw off the type of woman she was at the start. Like, it's very basic, but it is a kid's film. So it's a little thing, you know, she's terrified of bugs. By the end, there's, you know, an obstacle in front of her. She has to cross a whatever of bugs to save the day, and she does it. She doesn't even think about it. Because the moment she has with the elephant, where she thinks it's the elephant around her neck and it's a snake, she doesn't know she's doing it, so it doesn't count.
If she saved Indy at one point,
yeah,
that would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chris?
Okay.
Doing a bit of typing.
So, yeah, because I'm thinking about what I'm going to say here. So thinking about this white saviour issue, and I don't think this would fix it, but I think it would help. And unfortunately, I'm going to get rid of Short Round here. Okay. And have, if Indy's got to have a kid sidekick, have it be an Indian kid who goes on this adventure with him, maybe from that village, and have the kid help out at the end in terms of saving the day. I think that would help some of that questionable narrative. And I think it's an easy fix.
It's interesting. Mine would be a simple thing where there's a part that of me that even as a kid was like, Short Round couldn't do that. There's a bit where there's about six Indian guards and he manages to accidentally or somehow knock them all down in a row. And I'm like, you've crossed the line there. These people need to be a threat to me. And the fact that Short Round's just knocked out six of them,
yeah,
is like, I don't need Short Round to do that. Him having a really intense fight with the Maharaja, great, but not wiping out bad guys en masse. So there's a bit too much slapstick in the fights, which ruins them. No verdict.
I know.
Feels weird.
Can I mention a connection that I saw between the two of them because it made me laugh?
There's loads of connections.
But can I just mention one because it made me laugh?
All right.
A fruit plate for the ladies. Because when Marion is with Belloc in the tent, he brings her a plate of fruit. When Willie hasn't eaten, she gets given a plate of fruit. So all women eat in these films is fruit. And it just made me laugh, that's all. Sorry.
All right.
All right.
Well, that says done then. You excited about next week, Last Crusade?
Yeah, really excited. Oh, how was that? Was everyone, you're happy? It was fun, wasn't it?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I've enjoyed it, yeah. Do we have a winner out of those two? Do you think one of those could possibly win?
Potentially.
Yes, potentially. Well, obviously, potentially. I mean, yeah, it could.
I reckon they've both got a 1 in 4 chance.
Exactly.
Right then, we will leave you now. We are doing on Monday Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. On Thursday next week, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Until then, if you haven't already subscribed to us, please do on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Back on Monday, talking the Last Crusade. Bye-bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.